Right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I have the honour of opening this session, so and I also have the difficulty of keeping to time, and I'm sure my colleagues will remind me if I go over. Thank you very much for the invitation to ICAO to come and speak. My opening session will be on aviation greenhouse gas emissions, and the outline of the talk that I'm going to give is very briefly on aviation emissions and radiative forcing. Yesterday you will have heard much in a tutorial session about some of the science, so I'm not going to dwell too much on some of the details, and certainly my colleagues will be covering that. Asking the question which emissions really matter, then having a brief look at historical aviation emissions, potential future aviation emissions, and then I want to consider the concept of accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere and draw some brief conclusions. Well, one of the major things that this community has learnt from the science community, dating back to the IPCC report of 1999, in terms of its effect on climate, aviation is more than just CO2. I won't dwell on this long, but this kind of diagram showing radiative forcing, where the red bars are positive, warming, and the negative bars are cooling, is a very common sight. And we amongst the science community, we have the joke of, you know, how many times are you going to show the same chart in the same conference? I guess this one will crop up a couple of times, maybe. But aviation is more than CO2, but I will focus this time on CO2, and I would refer you to talks in following given by Professor Schumann, Waits, and Sausen on the non-CO2 aspects in both the specifics and the generalities. Well, much to probably Ian's amusement, this is my attempt at an engineering type diagram. That, believe it or not, is an engine, and the input is fuel in a C12H23 mostly, with a little bit of sulfur, and you have nitrogen and oxygen going in, and the pollutants across the bottom are those the things that come out. And this is just one way of looking at things. And roughly, those things that I've just outlined cause warming, they're positive. And sulfur oxides cause cooling, and nitrogen oxides are very complicated, and they cause both ozone production and methane destruction. This is trying to represent very, very many complex chemical reactions into a simple chart, but roughly that's kind of what happens. Going to CO2, it's the only significant long-lived greenhouse gas emission from aviation. The other aviation non-CO2 effects are much shorter lived, but as long as aviation is emitting, they remain as important as CO2 in that context. And again, I'm going to refer you to talks by my colleagues to my right. But the unique thing about CO2 is once you've done it, you've done it. If you put CO2 in the atmosphere, you've effectively banked it for a very, very long time, and its effects are going to persist for many thousands of years. Well, this is a brief look at the history of aviation emissions. The top chart shows fuel usage over time. 1940 is about the significant start of aviation, and the black line shows you fuel usage, which simple conversion factor goes to CO2, and you can see the blue line represents aviation growth in the conventional revenue passenger kilometres. And you can see that they're more or less coupled, but the RPK tends to grow faster than the aviation emissions, largely due to the overall efficiency of the system improving all the time. The lower chart shows you global anthropogenic CO2 emissions in the black line, and the red line, with a multiplied just for convenience by factor 10, shows you how aviation emissions have been increasing over time, but also the fraction has been increasing over time. You commonly hear it's 2%, it's less than 2%. No, it's not. It's a little bit more than that. That 2% type number tends to come from UNFCCC statistics, which are inherently incomplete. This is global kerosene usage, so it's much more accurate. Well, looking at futures, what kind of futures do we have in front of us in terms of aviation emissions? Well, one can take a range of aviation scenarios out to 2050. This was done in the IPCC report and has been updated several times because improvements in knowledge, improvements in estimates of how CO2 emissions may change according to technology, etc. And I've taken two subsets of fairly recent projections, one from a project that Robert will talk about in some detail, the Quantify project, where our scenarios have just been published in Environmental Science and Technology, but also the CAPE-8 emission projections through FESG, which was done at the request of GIAC. Well, I'm going to show you three charts, and they differ, and I want to point out how they differ, because I'm going to go from emission through to effect. So this chart shows you aviation emissions from 2000 onwards, and it shows the potential range of futures according to these scenarios. And what you see is roughly a factor of 2.5 in the emission estimates by 2050. However, if you take this through to effects, my first effect, if you like, is the commonly known metric radiative forcing. This is how we generally talk about in the science community about aviation and other effects on climate. But you'll have seen that the gap has narrowed. This is just CO2. I am not dealing with non-CO2 forcing and other emissions. So what you see here is this is reducing to a factor of 1.5 between the lower and the upper estimate bounds. Now, if I take that once more and translate it to an effect that is a little bit more tangible in terms of temperature response, you see it gets narrower still. And that's roughly a factor of 1.2 between the lower and the upper boundaries. So this is why, from the science point of view, looking at the emissions alone is not such an optimistic story, because we know that these ranges of effects actually collapse down. Now, why is that? Now, maybe I can simplify that a little bit in the following chart. In this calculation, what we've done is emit a single amount of CO2 only once, just once, in the year 2000. And this is the temperature response of the climate system to that pulse. So it doesn't go away quickly. On the contrary, it lasts a very, very long time. And that line would go on for an extremely long time, hundreds and hundreds of years. And a fraction of it would actually go on for thousands. So I'm moving on to the accumulative carbon dioxide type context. Now, one of the misconceptions that we often hear, and I think it's important that you know this, carbon dioxide does not have a lifetime of about 100 to 150 years. That's a gross simplification. It's convenient, and it gives an idea of a long lifetime. However, it is important to understand the details. It has several timescales of removal. About the first 50% of a small increase will be removed within 30 years, and a further 30% within a few centuries. The remaining 20% stays up there for many thousands of years. So once you've done it, you've done it. You can't reverse that out. This is to do with the complexity of the carbon cycle. I won't go into that, but you'll just have to take this as read. This is from the IPCC report in 2007. I'll have to move quite swiftly now. Well, what about this vexed question? We're looking for 2 degrees C as a maximum in terms of climate stabilization. Well, a fairly recent and simple approach looks at a total accumulative amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And this paper by Miles Allen and colleagues in the journal Nature outlines this. And what they say is if we emit 1 trillion tons of carbon dioxide expressed as carbon, that will result in a temperature increase of 2 degrees C with a certain uncertainty range. What you need to know is we've spent half of that already. And from the carbon cycle type approach, you can see that that's not going to go away. Well, if we look at carbon dioxide concentration over a very long time, and please draw your eye to the middle line, the purple one. Yes, it is purple. That gives a concentration level of about 450 parts per million. And that would probably stabilize temperatures around that kind of value with a certain uncertainty range. That emission profile is what we need to do in order to achieve that. Now, please notice how severe that is. We start from 1990, but by 2015, 2020, we have to turn that global emission line down. Currently, we are doing exactly the wrong thing. We are doing exactly the opposite to that. So if we put aviation in context to that line, and I've now truncated it to 2000 to 2050, you can see that aviation, under a kind of business as usual range of scenarios, those are just four of the many that I showed you, it's starting to increase at a particular rate, and it will consume a particular amount of carbon. This table just points out the high and low fractions. As an endpoint at 2050, the high scenario will consume about 17.3%, but in an accumulative sense, it's taking up about 6.8%, and the low scenario is 7.1% as an endpoint, and 4.3% as a cumulative rate. So that's 4.3% by 2050 of what we've got left to spend. So, I would suggest that the challenge on CO2 is pretty clear, and I'd actually suggest that the solution is very clear. Limit the global amount of carbon dioxide to a certain amount, and then we're looking for a certain temperature response, which will produce certain effects on the environment, the economy, social aspects, etc. But the critical question is, who gets how much? So, just to draw some brief conclusions, in the absence of policy intervention, what we expect to see is that aviation emission rates will increase from 2005 levels by about 2 to 4.5%. Two to four and a half fold by 2050. However, I'd like to try and get across to you that the rate at any individual point in time, the amount of emissions per year, is actually less relevant to the actual ultimate effect than the accumulative amount. So the integrated or cumulative CO2 emissions is a much better measure of climate change than the annual emission rate. And the key question is, how much will aviation be allowed of this? Because we know how much we can emit, we know that roughly what that will do, so we need to decide what's going to happen. Briefly to acknowledge my colleagues at MMU and the supporting ministry which has sponsored this work, the Department for Transport, I'd like to thank you for your attention.